from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Could peace be coming to Gaza? It appeared at press time Tuesday that a deal would be announced between Palestinian resistance groups and Israeli officials, who reportedly reached an agreement on a permanent ceasefire for the besieged Gaza Strip. According to Palestinian sources, the Palestinians and the Israelis agreed to a permanent ceasefire Tuesday. An unnamed senior Palestinian official was reported by media as saying, quote, "The contacts that have been going on have agreed a permanent ceasefire, a deal to end the blockade and a guarantee that Gaza's demands and needs will be met," closed quote. We'll have more details on that in tomorrow's newscast. Fighting continued in East Ukraine while in Kiev. The government was dissolved with new elections set for October, and Ukraine's leader, Petro Poroshenko, meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin Tuesday in Minsk. The two greeted each other with a handshake as they met in the Belarusian capital at the start of talks between the Eurasian Customs Union, the EU, and Kiev on the Ukrainian crisis. The two presidents may also hold bilateral talks on the issues in Ukraine later in the day. The negotiations in Minsk are part of a Eurasian Customs Union summit, which also includes Ukrainian president and representatives of the EU. The Eurasian Customs Union is Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. Meanwhile, Kiev claimed it captured a dozen Russian soldiers who crossed into Ukraine at night. A source in Russia's defense ministry has reportedly confirmed they went over the border, but said it was a mistake during a routine border patrol. We have this from RT's Paula Slyer.
Well, Kiev was the first to announce that it had detained Russian soldiers. There is a video that has now been posted to Facebook that purportedly shows the soldiers being questioned. You can see them reading what seems to be a statement off a piece of paper, and you can hear someone in the background presumably giving them instructions of what to say. An unnamed source in the Russian Defense Ministry says the soldiers were patrolling the Russian-Ukrainian border at night when they unintentionally crossed over into Ukrainian territory. What we're also hearing from the source is that the soldiers were detained without giving any kind of resistance. It's important to make the point that this happened at night, where it's very difficult, if not impossible, at some points to tell where exactly is the border line. We're talking here about a border that often goes through a field, a forest, or even a village. I've crossed this border on several occasions during the day, so you can imagine how much easier it is during the day. And I can tell you from personal experience that there are many, many parts where there's simply no markings to say that now you're in the Russian territory, now you're in Ukrainian territory. So how much more difficult it is at night. There have been several occasions in the past where Ukrainian soldiers themselves have crossed over into Russian territory. There was one instance where two armored vehicles crossed over and the crew tried to escape. At the beginning of August, there was just over 400 Ukrainian troops who crossed over into Russia, reportedly seeking sanctuary. This happened in an area in eastern Ukraine which has seen the fiercest fighting between the anti-government fighters and the Ukrainian military. There is here constant shelling, and there's also a humanitarian crisis that is unfolding. We traveled with a group of anti-government fighters to one of the worst hit cities, where essentially people are under siege, and these fighters risked their lives to bring much needed supplies to the residents of the town.
Despite warnings from Syria that it would consider any air attacks inside its territory that are committed without specific approval by Damascus as aggression, Washington began taking preliminary steps toward a U.S. bombing campaign against the group alternately known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State. The raids would take place both in Iraq and Syria. According to a report in the New York Times Tuesday, U.S. President Barack Obama has authorized surveillance flights over Syria, a precursor to potential airstrikes there. U.S. military officials said Monday that the Pentagon was sending in manned and unmanned reconnaissance flights over Syria using a combination of aircraft, including drones and possibly U-2 spy planes. One senior administration official reportedly said that the president approved the flights over the weekend. Administration officials said the U.S. did not intend to notify the Syrian government of the planned flights, which would be a significant step towards direct American military action in Syria. David Swanson is the publisher of the website warisacrime.org. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford about who the real winners and losers are in the battles with ISIS, Iraq, Syria, and others. Ford asked Swanson what role is being played by the U.S. Congress in all of this new fighting.
It's kind of a slap in the face because Congress, the House, not the Senate, but the House voted just about 2 weeks before this new bombing campaign was launched to forbid any illegal, that is unconstitutional, war, already forbidden, of course, by the Constitution, by the president without any congressional declaration of war. So they passed that. And then 2 weeks later, while they're out of town, President Obama starts something that he could have started while they were in town, and he could have asked them, and his pretense that it's always an emergency, as in Libya, as in Syria, and so forth, is just not credible. But to his relief, I suppose, just about every single member of Congress, right down to Bernie Sanders and Barbara Lee, said, "We support what you're doing." So the possibility of Congress pushing back immediately became much more unlikely and much more of a difficult ask for activists, which is quite a turn from the position that Congress took on Syria, the position that even the Senate took earlier this year on toughening sanctions and moving into a likely war with Iran, and the rhetoric that was coming out of the House just a couple of weeks ago. So this is a president who gets away with these things because he's a Democrat and because he is claiming to be doing small wars and efficient wars and robotized wars that don't risk the sort of lives that we're supposed to care about, Americans. And so we've gotten to a place with the public as well, where the public doesn't want any major ground war, any risk to U.S. lives, but is okay with launching missiles at anybody, anywhere, anytime, regardless of the fact that countless innocent people are going to die in the process, and the process is not going to be controllable, and it's likely going to escalate.
And on Capitol Hill, the opposition has evaporated, even Barbara Lee, as you mentioned, Barbara Lee being the only person on the Hill to vote against the invasion of Afghanistan. Even Barbara Lee is mute on the subject.
Yeah, and worse than mute. And, you know, you have these heroic moments where 50 years ago this month that the House voted unanimously and the Senate voted with two exceptions for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, knowing what that would mean to the people of Vietnam, 4 million dead, as that was allowed to go on without any congressional resistance for years. And yet one senator, Wayne Morse, one of the two who voted the right way, stood up and laid out all the facts and was denounced as a crackpot. Just as Barbara Lee found that moment of courage on Afghanistan, just as Jeanette Rankin found that moment of courage on World War II, having also voted against World War I. But these moments of heroism come and go and depend quite a bit on the circumstances, including partisan alignments, the party of the president, the type of war, the public mood, and so forth. Finding someone who is, as a matter of principle and wisdom and understanding, against war in all of its evil is quite hard to do. We know that Congressman Kucinich was closer in that direction than many of his colleagues and was driven out in large part by military spending on the campaign of arrival.
And so it seems that the War Powers Act is null and void at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, at the White House and with the Congress.
Well, they claim that it's not. And of course, the Constitution, as I read it, forbids any sort of presidential war without congressional declaration and approval. And under Article 6 makes both the UN Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact the supreme law of the land as treaties to which the United States is party to. All of these wars violating the UN Charter and any conceivable war violating the Kellogg-Briand Pact. But the War Powers Resolution of 1973 is understood radically differently by anybody you ask. And under the president's interpretation, his wars are emergencies and they comply with the War Powers Act, and he's reporting to Congress on what he's doing, and that's all that's needed. And according to Congress, including Congresswoman Lee, that's all well and good and not a big problem. There are even those who interpret the War Powers Resolution to refer only to U.S. troops on the ground and not to missiles. Harold Coe, one of Obama's lawyers in recent years, has pursued that interpretation and told Congress that dropping bombs on Libya would not be war or hostilities. These would be somehow non-hostile bombs. So if you're going to allow lawyers to say that black is white and white is black and up is down, you can comply with just about any law you want.
In defending his Libya bombing and claiming that it did not fall under the War Powers Act, President Obama essentially said that there is no war if Americans are not killed.
That's right. I had one of the key authors, a former Republican congressman, on my radio show a few weeks ago, one of the key authors of the War Powers Act, and this was certainly not his interpretation or understanding of anyone's interpretation at the time, but this is one way that you can comply with the law. You can weaken it to the point almost of meaninglessness. So if you haven't got U.S. troops dying yet, then you haven't got a violation of the War Powers Act. Well, that's only going to hold up in a corrupt sort of court. But as William Bundy, a CIA, a so-called defense guy, said back during the Vietnam War, there is an advantage to spilling U.S. blood to those who want to escalate a war. And I know that ISIS had to be aware that slitting throats on camera would result in more bombing, just as President Obama had to be aware that blowing men, women, and children up with 500-pound bombs would result in slitting throats. The beneficiaries of this escalation, which is entirely predictable, are the weapons makers. There are people, no matter what Paul Krugman says in the New York Times, there are people who profit from war. They just aren't most of us.
The administration is framing the more recent bombings in Iraq as part of a humanitarian stance by the United States, something they say about everything the U.S. military does these days. But you point out that minority groups in Iraq, like the Yazidis, were actually pushed towards insecurity by the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Oh, there's no question that the invasion and occupation in the years following 2003 resulted in massive deaths and virtual elimination of a number of minority groups, including Christian groups in Iraq. So for the United States to take this moral high ground and say we're going to use a little clean war to prevent a genocide and violence, as if the Pentagon never engages in violence, and a massive level of violence, as if the 500,000 to 1.5 million Iraqis killed during the U.S. occupation of just those years, and just in excess of the death rate that existed following previous U.S. wars and sanctions, has been remotely approached by the level of killing engaged in by these terrorist groups. The question, of course, is whether dropping the bombs is going to help these people or make things worse. And you have a U.S. military that is clearly largely uninformed about what is happening on the ground there, shows up on the mountain expecting to find 20, 30,000 people and finds 4,000, most of them having inconveniently escaped too soon. It does not have any idea where ISIS is or what it's doing, that runs a rescue mission to rescue hostages and finds nobody home, and yet claims to know exactly where it's dropping bombs and who it's dropping bombs on, and that it's killing only the proper people and they don't need to bother counting the bodies. And so it's extremely unconvincing. And of course, it's not a solution that lasts beyond next week. You have to keep dropping bombs forever. And as you drop those bombs and generate more enemies and more hostility and more thirst for vengeance on both sides, what becomes of those people? So there are other solutions. This idea that you can only drop bombs or do nothing is a very American idea. Other people around the world see crises and think, let's send in negotiators, let's send in aid, let's send in, if necessary, police, but not 500-pound bombs. That has not been shown ever to have bettered a situation in the past, and yet there's this constant will to believe it will in the current instance.
One would think that the United States would know a great deal about ISIS, since ISIS in its present form would not exist except for the U.S. desire for regime change in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, this is the crazy thing always about this notion of the U.S. riding in on a white horse to intervene in a situation that has resulted from the irrational medieval barbarism of foreigners. The United States created the sectarian divide, created the hostile level of violence, created the deprivation and resentment and illegitimate government in Baghdad, has been supplying ISIS and allied groups with weaponry in Syria, or what used to be Syria, has been supplying weaponry to Iraq, which has been seized by ISIS. So if you work in the U.S. weapons industry, you have to be proud, not just of the wars of your own country, which you may bow down in allegiance to, but of being a provider of 79% of the weaponry that goes into the Middle East, and the number one provider of weaponry to ISIS. So if we think of the Middle East as a violent place, and it certainly is, but it is also a very heavily armed place, most of those arms coming from the United States, and most of the rest from its allies, and a place that is heavily exploited. And Paul Krugman tells the New York Times that wars are not fought for economic reasons because wars do not benefit the populations of the countries that wage them. Well, if there were not oil in Iraq, we would not be having this conversation. And the fact that that oil does not benefit you and me and most people of the United States, or most people of Iraq for that matter, is irrelevant to the fact that there are motivations of profit and greed that feed into the motivations of political advantage and domination and machismo and sadism that drive these wars. And one side or the other, the bomb droppers or the throat slitters, is going to have to move to a higher ground and break out of the cycle of violence. And right now, it doesn't look like it's going to be the bomb droppers.
As politicians and journalists and everyday people try to assess exactly what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, over the past weeks, a number of reports from people who were on the ground there are starting to surface. We have this one from Gloria LaRiva, who's an activist and journalist who was in Ferguson over the past weeks. She was shot in the face with a rubber bullet by police. She spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar this past weekend.
Mike Brown was murdered on the 9th, and immediately that afternoon, that night, and every day since, there have been protests. A convenience store and gas station that called the QT became the center of all the demonstrations, gatherings, public activity, right on one of the main streets of Ferguson called West Florissant Avenue. And that was really like ground zero. It was burned down in the very early days, and it was being empty. That's where people gathered, and there was many, many activities there. It has since been taken over by all the police forces. People are prohibited even from stopping on the corner or nearby. They're ordered to keep walking. And every day, the repression has grown greater. More police forces of various counties, towns, the state troopers, and now we see the National Guard. And it's going to take even more struggle, which the community of Ferguson is completely prepared for. When we were there, myself and Jameer Sale first arrived there on Saturday the 16th. Anybody you talk to, young and old, mostly African American, but some white people, would say that they were not going to stop, and that the officials were completely wrong if they thought that the repression was going to keep them from protesting.
That's the voice of Gloria LaRiva, and this is Liberation Radio. This week, we devote the entire program to the struggle in Ferguson. Gloria was on the scene reporting as militant journalist for Liberation News. Gloria, I'm hoping that you might be able to put people on the scene of some of the protests as well as the police response.
Well, one of the main protests that took place when we had not yet arrived was the day, finally, after several days, that the city officials were finally forced to issue the name of the cop. His name is Darren Wilson. But the same day that that happened, the police chief, who had supposedly been overridden by the state trooper captain, Ron Johnson, the police chief issued a 19-page report a supposed report about an alleged, what they called a strong arm robbery by Mike Brown, the same day that he was killed, of little cigars, cigarillos from a small store. But of course, nobody knew that before he was killed. And it was a video that was also issued from that store, and it was played on television. I remember on CNN, it was like breaking news. It turns out that Mike Brown was involved in the strong arm robbery. And so that really pushed people into great anger and a huge mobilization that night. There was some breaking of windows of some businesses, but it was the abuse that people felt by demanding one step of justice, the naming of the cop, and then in turn the police go and issue, try to demonize Mike Brown in the middle of it. So that was even mentioned by Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC News. She challenged the governor and said, why isn't the police chief fired or forced to resign? And she said to the governor, that was an escalation that was a, she said to the governor, that was a provocation to issue that video of Mike Brown, allegedly Mike Brown. So that was one day. And then on Saturday, when we arrived there, we attended the press conference of Governor Jay Nixon, and it was many, many journalists, many community people were there, and he declared a curfew that would be issued that night at 12 midnight, really making people angry. And it was very interesting because we went out into the street, went to the QT, and within a couple of hours, there was a massive turnout of people from the community, hundreds of cars going up and down the avenue, along with a lined street of people with their homemade signs, curfew does not bring justice, hands up, don't shoot. That's the most famous chant that people chant, holding their hands up while they're marching. But it was one of the greatest displays of a community mobilization I have ever seen. And what it showed us is that there is a united movement demanding justice for Mike Brown. And for all the youth, all the people in the black community who've been harassed, and also some white youth. I mean, there are white youth who told us that they're fed up with being accosted by the police. So that march lasted a couple of hours. Then as the curfew approached, the 12 midnight curfew, the first night of curfew, by the end of, as the clock struck 12, there were about 70 people there. We ourselves decided if the youth were going to be there, we were going to be there with them after the curfew. And in the meantime, a large line of police formed, and about 12:30, despite the fact that the youth were just standing in the street, hands up, very peaceful gathering, the police fired tear gas, smoke bombs, and rubber bullets. We had to flee the area. The place was cleared out. And the next day, on Sunday, there was a church religious ceremony of 2,000 people. Al Sharpton was the main speaker. That lasted a few hours. And then people moved again to the QT. And by 8 p.m., this was 4 hours before the curfew, the second night of curfew. So people reasonably thought that they would be safe marching, protesting, expressing their rights until midnight. Well, the march started at 8 p.m., and it quickly grew to 3,000 people. It was young, old, little kids. Mothers formed a contingent with babies and baby strollers. So it was this big, peaceful march. The Answer Coalition was helping, in monitoring. And the banner that we had, people said, bring the banner up front because it said, stop racist police terror. And as we marched peacefully down the street, one of the leaders of the march had declared, we will be marching to the police station, you know, to have a rally there. It wasn't inflammatory language, but as it got close to 9 and we approached the end of the street to turn right to the police station, all of a sudden, several militarized vehicles, big tank-like vehicles with these huge lights and sound. They blocked us immediately and began to fire without warning. They fired a huge volley of rubber bullets, of tear gas, of smoke bombs, concussion grenade, and people began to flee. Some people got hit. I immediately got hit in the leg by a rubber bullet. Let me tell you, they're extremely painful. And it was a complete rout. It was the worst assault I have personally ever seen of police in a demonstration. And through the whole length, almost a mile and a half of the street, these military vehicles mowed down people, pushing them ahead, firing constantly until they cleared the area. At 1:15 in the morning, after the police basically took over a huge militarized besieged place, they held a press conference. At Sunday, Monday morning at 1:15, they called the media in the middle of that war zone to explain why they responded to the protests the way they did. And they claimed that there was a Molotov cocktail that was launched against them. And we, who were right in front near those vehicles, know that that is completely false. It's very important with all the media attention on Ferguson that people who are concerned about the situation, who are supportive of the struggle for justice for Mike Brown, to read the progressive media. Liberation News has been covering it almost hourly, and the Answer Coalition as well, to read on the ground. There are many independent journalists and others as well who've been attacked by the police themselves, shot with rubber bullets, threatened, arrested. There's been quite a number of journalists actually arrested, and they were even warned by the police to separate themselves physically from the demonstrators. How do you do coverage if you can't talk to people in the street? So that's just some of the challenges taking place. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, continued protests, but increasing prohibition of people to gather, the fundamental right of free speech, free assembly has been basically gutted. And this is a long, long struggle. This will not be resolved overnight because the pressure has to continue. Already we find that the government is saying that the federal investigation will take months. And you ask anybody there and they say, why is it taking months? Even the second autopsy, which was arranged by the family, shows, and one of the people who conducted the autopsy said that the way that he was shot in the head, which was a fatal shot of Mike Brown, he said it shows that there's enough evidence to indict the police. But what I think that the federal, state, city, county officials fear is the example being set by the community of Ferguson, that if you organize, stay determined, raise your voice, march in the street, and demand justice, and stay basically united, that you can win against the police state. And they really worry about that. Already, yesterday, I mean, 3, 2, 1. Already on Tuesday, another young man, 23-year-old, he apparently had a psychological crisis. He was in a store. He had supposedly a knife, and the police came in and gunned him down. So it's very serious. It's not a unique case. We're talking hundreds of killings in the country, black, Latino, white, but mainly black and Latino youth who are being killed by the cops. And so Mike Brown is really a symbol, a worldwide symbol, and Ferguson is an international symbol of resistance.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.